The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, equipping and supporting New York's startup business community with Mac repairs and upgrades, on-site setup and support, free seminars and events, equipment rentals, sales, consultation, and more. Studio.techserve.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening, and a special welcome to listeners in Southern Colorado who are listening to us for the very first time on KRCC. We are going to step away from the grim political drama emerging from the sudden death of Justice Antonin Scalia over the weekend. Oh, there is plenty to say, and later this week, as the knee-jerk rhetoric of the partisan pundit classes dies down, some of the subtler implications of Scalia's legacy will become clear, and we will step into that with gusto, I assure you. But we are dedicating this whole hour to the long historical challenge of protecting water rights and water quality in industrial America. Not many people know just how much Justice Scalia was actually involved in this mission. Scalia hated chaos and uncertainty. He helped to oversee the settlement of the largest water rights claims in U.S. history, a case that took 27 years. The Snake River Basin adjudication resolved 158,000 Idaho water rights cases. Speaking in Idaho in 2014, Scalia said that the case eliminated uncertainty and cleared the way for 1 million people's drinking water and provided irrigation water to 3 million acres. Cataloging private property rights, he said, goes back at least to William of Normandy's conquest of Britain when he required cattle to be counted so he could tax them, Scalia said, noting the ancient water disputes that have shaped the laws of today. What can you say about your water? Are you certain of its quality? Babies just love to get a bath in the sink or the tub and feel the strange, clear stuff. Water. An innocent baby, a tender mother, or a father giving their child a loving bath in pure water. It's a life-affirming experience of trust that reminds us of the fragility of life itself, reminding us how dependent we all are in everything we do on water.
We're spoiled in the United States. When we wake up in the morning, we turn on a tap, and out comes as much water as we want of high quality for less than we pay for cell phone service or for cable television. When most of us think about water, we think of it as though it were the air, infinite and inexhaustible, when in fact it's not.
This hour, water and America's curious relationship to it. We'll hear from people who, like almost all Americans, assume that pure water will be there whenever they need it or even when they don't really need it. The green sound of water sprinklers, a sign of America's water abundance. Here are some sounds of water's scarcity.
As California suffers through an unprecedented drought that we've been covering over half the state, now facing the most severe conditions.
Very likely the single worst drought of the last 150 years and possibly approaching the worst drought of the last 500 to 1,000 years.
They say that before it was a whole lake, and we went to see it and we only see partial of the lake. The other parts are dry.
And we're looking at warmer temperatures, a record low snowpack, just tells me how much of a drought we're really in.
Or the sounds of water's contamination, where faucets suddenly deliver strange-smelling, slow-acting poison.
A protest is happening this evening up in Flint over the water crisis there.
The first test showed elevated lead levels.
In children, the effects of lead sometimes take months, if not years, to develop.
Lead exposure results in lowered IQs and behavioral problems.
Now she's even started to use bottled water to bathe her daughter, London.
It makes me itchy.
She had dug so bad in her scalp. She was bleeding her scalp.
There were times that we would be taking a shower, and if you happened to have a cut or a scrape, your shower would just burn. It would burn like you were sticking your hand in acid. The cut or the scrape or any kind of open skin would just be like liquid fire coming down on your skin. And there's just no way that anybody could convince me that that was safe.
Melissa Mays in Flint tried to get the authorities to listen to her for months, and they didn't. Who do you call when you have a water crisis?
Here the first responder really is the primacy agency, which in this case was the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality.
We turn now to the story of someone who relied on well water and who discovered how alone she was when she began to suspect that something was very wrong with her water. Jennifer Hall Massey lives in a small community near Charleston, West Virginia, known for its rushing streams and rivers and lush forests. But it is also right in the center of coal country.
You know, sometimes when we're faced with illness, we're more focused on how to fix it, how to overcome it, and not necessarily the cause. So we had experienced high levels of health effects within the community, really didn't realize that our neighbors were experiencing the same things. It was probably in 2007, there was a flyer at a local convenience store that said, if you're interested in city water and you live in this area, to go to a church, you know, they're going to have a meeting at a church. And it was while we were at that meeting, my little brother was 29. He had passed away the year before that. And while we were at that meeting, I realized we had six neighbors in a 10-house span that had brain tumors. You know, only two survived.
And no one tested your water. No one came to you to certify that your water was good. No one seemed to be concerned about what might be leaching into the aquifer in your neighborhood?
After that meeting, there ended up being a lawsuit, so it was more private testing. We approached the health department, and you know, they're only concerned about bacteria, and what we had in our water was basically contaminants that are found in a sludge pond or a slurry pond. The problem with local officials performing the studies in this state, you know, our state is primarily a coal industry, and the industry that was contaminating us is also the industry that the state makes all of their money from. So it kind of puts them in an awkward situation as well, and sometimes they work harder to pretend you don't exist than just to do the right thing and keep the companies within their permit levels. The coal company that was in our backyard, they were a bad apple. It was cheaper for them to pay small fines than it was to work within their permits.
Any things you noticed about the taste of the water, the effect that it had on your body, the, you know, what it felt like to take a shower that made you suspect that it was a little bit different, especially if you traveled somewhere else?
I have two children. They're now 12 and 14. When they were little, anytime we would leave the water and come back into the water, my youngest one, he would get scabs and stuff on his body, you know, dental issues. You know, the more we brushed his teeth, the worse they were. And then when we figured out it was the water, you know, his teeth are fine now. Thankfully, it was his baby teeth. Myself, you know, have a lot of crowns. You just really don't think of it while you're in it. You're more along the lines of thinking of, okay, what do we have to do to, you know, fix this health problem? You know, even my brother, you know, had a brain tumor when they first diagnosed him. You're just going through the steps to fix it and really don't think of the cause.
How did you get your water system changed, and then what happened after that?
Public awareness is really what got us pushed through the system. When I first contacted our commissioners about getting water, you know, I was informed that our community was offered city water in the 60s, and they didn't want it. So, you know, it would be at least 10 years. And, you know, I just told them, we're going to be dead in 10 years. The entire community still does not have water, but the majority of the population does. So that was a blessing for us.
And the municipal water comes from where?
Charleston.
Is that part of the Elk River system?
Yes, it absolutely is. We also had a spill with that water in 2014. The chemical that was spilled in the Elk River is a chemical that's used to clean coal.
So your experience, and, you know, we're talking about a lifetime of health compromises and surgeries and loss of, in the case of your brother, lives. And, you know, look at Flint, and it's a situation where nobody knew anything about it for 18 months and no one paid any attention for 18 months. And all of a sudden, it's an emergency. What does that say about this country's awareness of the importance of drinking water?
First off, no person, no company, no industry, no state should even have the opportunity to contaminate in that manner. And, you know, I feel for the people of Flint. Like I said, I'm glad at least they're acknowledging it. In our area, they worked very hard to honestly make us go away, pretend we didn't exist. Oh, there's nothing wrong there. When indeed, you know, there was a lot wrong with the story. The problem was, you know, we were very small. There was about 300 in our community.
How's your water now?
We have, like I said, we're on a municipal water supply coming out of the Elk River in Charleston, West Virginia. When we had the spill, you know, of course, there was an immediate need because all the water through the pipes was contaminated. They didn't drain the storage facilities, clean them properly. So therefore, it's going to be a dilution as far as how all of the chemical gets out of the system. And so we do not drink it. We do bathe in it and do laundry in it. But yeah, there's no way I drink it. I don't use the ice because, again, they did not drain the tanks. So it's going to run its course.
How much have you spent to make your water acceptable or to get water that is acceptable for your family?
Wow. I really don't know. But, you know, we, like I said, we definitely use bottled water for drinking and cooking, you know, until... I really don't know when I will ever get comfortable with water that's coming out of the pipes here in Charleston, West Virginia, because of the spill in 14.
Do you think anybody should be confident about their water based on the experience that you've had and in Flint? It's so easy for people to think, oh, that's just strange communities with industries nearby. And Flint, of course, you know, they're bankrupt. And of course, that's going to happen there. Is there any reason to think it wouldn't happen anywhere?
No, absolutely not. Anywhere, especially, like I said, here in Charleston, you've got such a, you know, coal is our industry, and it is our primary source of income for the state. So there's always going to be the risk that regulation can be overlooked. You know, it's just a stream. No, it's not just a stream. It's water that you're drinking. It's water that makes it through your pipes, and your children are drinking it. So, yeah, it can happen anywhere. And what happened here in 2014 with the citizens of Charleston was similar to what happened in our area. You know, first they try and tell you the water's okay, there's nothing wrong. But honestly, Charleston, West Virginia, and its surrounding communities, you know, there's no research that tells you the effect of that chemical on your health. And we are, whether we like it or not, a bunch of lab rats that time will tell, and we will be the research.
Jennifer Holm-Massey speaking to us from Charleston, West Virginia. Tell us about your water quality and the water infrastructure in your town.
This is Jim Curry from Columbus, Ohio, and I was concerned about the water supply and the quality before Flint, but Flint really carried the message about how all the systems that we rely on are deteriorating without really people paying as much attention as we need to.
Illinois, I live in suburban Chicago, 3 miles from both an oil refinery and a coal-fired power plant. My town uses municipal wells. I've used filters since day one just because I don't like the taste. After Flint, I have even better reason.
This is Lois Gridley. I'm calling from upstate New York. I do trust our water supply, but for the past year, concern has been growing about street collapses downtown due to aged pipes. With the national infrastructure aging, how many states face this crisis? Old pipes right along with the aging roads.
We're talking about water all this hour, from the tap in your home to the policies set by the federal government. Tell us your story. The number is 877-8-MY-TAKE. Much more at thetakeaway.org. And now a federal official's view of the legal uncertainties and ambiguities when a water crisis strikes. Joel Beauvais is the Deputy Assistant Administrator for the Office of Water at the Federal Environmental Protection Agency. The EPA's authority in protecting water and air quality has been under attack from legal challenges by states and local industries for years. Joel, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you very much for having me.
My first question is perhaps a blunt one, but how is the Flint situation not a complete failure of the whole EPA system that was designed to prevent precisely what it seems happened in Flint, Michigan?
Well, I think we need to remember the overall framework in which we oversee drinking water regulation here in this country. So Congress, under the Safe Drinking Water Act, really set up a system, a federalist system, in which states are given the primary regulatory authority, and states like Michigan are the ones that are charged with overseeing drinking water systems compliance with the Act. EPA is then in an oversight role looking at what the states are doing. So in this case, we really had Michigan in the lead role overseeing the activities in Flint.
Is there someone who acts as a first responder in a situation like Flint? If a building's on fire, boy, somebody gets involved pretty quickly. Contaminated water can have just as immediate effect on people's lives. And what is the first responder traditionally in America for a water contamination?
Here, the first responder really is the primacy agency, which in this case was the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality.
How involved is the EPA in assessing the age of infrastructure in urban areas all around the country and how prone they might be to corrosion effects?
EPA, on a national basis, takes a look at the drinking water needs across the country and our infrastructure needs. So our most recent survey came out in 2013. That was our 2011 needs survey that identified over $380 billion worth of investment needs for water infrastructure over the next 20 years. So those needs go beyond issues with regard to lead service lines, but they certainly point to the challenges that the country as a whole is facing in terms of aging infrastructure.
What is the likelihood that Congress would take up that investment or the state agencies that are directly responsible would take up that investment in anything like the time that the EPA thinks is really necessary to ensure the health of safe drinking water?
Well, there are a number of mechanisms that are used to fund water infrastructure investment, both at the federal and the state level. So the primary one of those are the state revolving funds. So Congress every year appropriates money through EPA's budget to be dedicated to state revolving funds in every state across the country. And those revolving funds then make low or no interest loans to water systems across the country to help fund needed investments. In addition, Congress recently has authorized a new program, the Water Infrastructure Finance and Innovation Act, that provides yet a new mechanism to leverage congressional appropriations to support loans for water infrastructure. So those are kind of the federal mechanisms, and many states, as I understand it, also supplement those with additional mechanisms.
So in theory, if I'm a mayor of some town that discovers something bad in the water and I can't deal with it directly, but I know what needs to be fixed, I can make a call either to a state or a federal agency and get the money to make sure that drinking water is safe and clean?
Well, certainly the state revolving funds provide and one source of potential low or no interest loans that systems can make use of in order to address challenges like this.
Can the EPA order an evacuation in a town if things get serious enough?
I've not heard of that particular step. The EPA does have authority under the Safe Drinking Water Act to require actions to address imminent substantial endangerment of public health. And in fact, we have exercised that authority in Flint with an order that was issued in January to the state of Michigan, the MDEQ, and the city of Flint.
Was that order perhaps a little delayed based on the experience of the residents?
We thought it was important to take that action at that point in time because there were continuing concerns with regard to the transparency of provision of information to the public, as well as with regard to, you know, the steps that needed to be taken to ensure that corrosion control was properly implemented at that point and that the water system could be safely and effectively maintained.
Is the EPA involved in the specific oversight of contaminants that can get into drinking water that are directly a result of all kinds of environmental impacts, consumer devices, consumer packaging, as well as industrial processes located near watersheds?
Well, it's really the Safe Drinking Water Act that's the framework that Congress has established for EPA to look at concerns with regard to drinking water. So that really sets up a whole framework for us to identify contaminants that may be of concern, to monitor for those contaminants, and then to assess whether regulatory action needs to be taken.
Is there a next Flint out there somewhere, Joel Bove?
I don't think so. I think that Flint really presents a series of very unique and unusual circumstances. Even the circumstance of moving from treated water that was purchased from Detroit to untreated water from the Flint River for a large system like Flint is quite unusual. And the series of steps or missteps on the part of the state regulators in particular is highly unusual. So there certainly are other challenges out there, but I think Flint is an outlier.
Joel Beauvais is Deputy Assistant Administrator for the Office of Water at the Environmental Protection Agency. Joel, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
What's the water story in your town? Fitchburg, Massachusetts. We have terrible water in my town. It's well water and stains everything. You used to have to get this stuff from town hall to run through the washing machine to keep your clothes from getting stained. All the porcelain is discolored. The town got a new filtration system that has improved this somewhat, but I wouldn't drink it. We get water delivered.
This is Cheryl from Arlington, Texas. My city's water is rated as one of the best in the area, so I don't fear for that. But I certainly think about the delivery systems we have all over the country and how at risk we are from our own fault and from attack.
Tell us your water story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. We move now to see for a moment just how different the experience is for people and water outside of the utopian expectations of the people in North America. Imagine a situation like Flint, Michigan, multiplied times 1,000. There are 99 million people in India who do not have access to clean water, which degrades every aspect of their daily lives. The World Bank estimates that unsafe water is responsible for 21% of the communicable diseases in India. Could a simple application of technology change the dismal fate of Indians trapped in places with unclean water? T. Pradeep, professor of chemistry at the Indian Institute of Technology in Chennai, has developed a filter that could be the answer for millions and is already providing contaminant-free water to 400,000 people in West Bengal and seven other Indian states. Professor Pradeep has proved that clean water delivers political power and hope.
It is quite important to make sure that affordable clean water is not a distant dream in several parts of the world. We are indeed in a position today to deliver such affordable solutions to people.
Why is it so unique that your filter removes both chemical contaminants and organic creatures? I would think that that capability would have been around for a while.
So if you look at the overall energy consumption, the environmental impact of this, the raw materials, our methodology is green. If you require, let us say, if you use a liter of water for the production of these materials, we create about 500 to 1,000 liters of clean water in the process of consuming these materials. So essentially, we produce a water-positive product, which is quite unique in comparison to many other products in the market.
How is the filter maintained, and how easy is it to educate families to use the filter properly? Because an improperly used filter could end up actually doing more damage.
Correct. It is important to implement these solutions and gradually educate people as we go along. Arsenic contamination is something that people are generally aware of, but you cannot see arsenic. You cannot taste arsenic. You cannot smell it. You can only see the effects over a long time. So it is important to ensure that the people are educated about the importance of clean water, about the importance of keeping their filters clean, about the importance of backwash or any such thing, to ensure, especially in a poor community where everyday living itself is so difficult.
Where have you piloted this device?
Right now, we are delivering arsenic-free water to 400,000 people. So it has gone beyond the early piloting stage. We have been implementing this technology in a state called West Bengal in India. But then it has also gone to 7 or 8 states now.
In terms of your dreams for the future, how many people could you help?
With this technology or similar technologies, we can ensure that the world is arsenic-free, the world is fluoride-free, the world is mercury-free. Why people should suffer from any of these contaminants? We can provide water free, clean water for all, can actually be given affordably. That would be my dream.
Could you get on a plane tomorrow and help the people of Flint?
Of course I can, but I need to know more about local problems, So I love to do such things. It is important to help people. Water is people's resource.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much indeed. It was a pleasure talking to you.
T. Pradeep is a professor of chemistry at the Indian Institute of Technology in Chennai. There are some in this country who say that water and access to water is the 21st century battleground for democratic rights and civil rights in America. The Flint crisis is a contamination disaster that an EPA official has already told us is an outlier. But our next guest isn't so sure. Maureen Taylor is helping the people of Flint to get clean water, but her water battles began years ago when the city of Detroit, just down the road, got an emergency manager in the middle of its financial crisis. Water shutoffs of residential customers began for tens of thousands of households with delinquent accounts. Maureen Taylor, state chair of the Michigan Welfare Rights Organization, fought back and says that America needs to wake up, that access to water is a basic human right. It's a battle she's lost in Detroit, she says, but she's been trying to make it a national issue.
I don't live in a bankrupt city. I live in a city that was bankrupted. And we continuously hear this phrase, well, this is a common practice. If you can't pay for water, you don't need it. But just never forget the fact that this started a number of years ago once an emergency manager was imposed. And these folks are able to sell off our assets to their families and friends, and they make whatever decisions that they want. Now the press, except for you, has decided to remove the spotlight away from Detroit and move it up the road 71 miles to Flint as if these fights are not connected.
And to relate what's going on in Flint to what's going on in Detroit, there it's a contamination issue. But in Detroit, the idea was that if you didn't pay your bills and this emergency manager had all this right, supposedly, to turn off your water, you had to go without. And you, by fighting back, were making the point that water is not like milk or gasoline or any other kind of commodity. It's something else.
It is. It's not cookies. We're not talking about buying a bag of Lay's potato chips here. You have to have water to live. And the fact that 70% of the people in Detroit live at or below the poverty level is very similar in Flint. They bring this question of, well, if you can't pay for water, then you can't have it. The last 6 months period of time, and today is, we're talking about February. If you count back 6 months, the water department in Detroit has disconnected service at somewhere around 34,000 households.
What do you think is going to be the upshot of this case? Do you think there will be, as a result of the Detroit battle that you're in the middle of right now, that a civil right to water will be established and that city authorities will not have this unilateral right to turn off water in residences, and this chain of other social problems won't start to happen, or that it'll be the opposite?
Well, we've already been in court with a Judge Rhodes who has already indicated in his findings that there is no civil or natural right to water. And so we lost that particular case in terms of the court outcomes, but we won that particular case because it put that question out into the universe. We would hope that there would be some sort of a national indication that says people have the right to water. We didn't ask for free water. No one has ever asked for free water. We wanted a water affordability plan where people would be allowed to pay for their water based on their income.
Well, Maureen, let's talk to the folks who are listening to this program who are far away from Detroit and who may have heard a lot in the media, oh, Detroit, that has its own problems. That's nothing like it'll ever happen here. There's no way they're going to take my water away. What would you say to them?
Well, that's what they always say. I'm sure that there were people in Germany that said, I've heard about these bad things that are happening over in the next township, but that won't happen to me. And then, you know, the story already. They came after the Jews, and I wasn't one. And then they came after the union organizers, and I wasn't one. And then they came after the welfare recipients. I wasn't one of those. They came after the Detroit residents, and I wasn't one of those. And then one day somebody knocked on my door. There was nobody there to do battle. this nightmare is going to come to a theater near you unless you wake up.
Activist Maureen Taylor speaking to us from Detroit, Michigan. The crisis in Flint, Michigan has been particularly disheartening to the quiet family of public servants, technological experts, and engineering leaders who maintain the infrastructure of America, often outside the political system and invisible to the general public. Tom Laughlin is the executive director of the American Society of Mechanical Engineers. He sees the Flint crisis as a call for Americans to better understand how things work and how they can better and more intelligently demand that things get fixed when they get old and break down.
It really is. But one of our challenges with engineering is that people don't understand it, right? If they take it for granted and it's just there, people don't appreciate all that's behind it. So the Flint water infrastructure is 100 years old, and the pipes are all there and they're underground. And when they changed their water source and it created these secondary problems, they were completely unprepared to deal with it. And then you think about the whole political infrastructure and all the various agencies weren't equipped to deal with it. And now we have to. And in a way, we ought to look at it as a canary in the coal mine for the entire infrastructure for this country.
Do you think engineers need to be more activists in terms of thinking about problems early, reminding people about the infrastructure they take for granted, educating them about things that they should know about so that it's not just it comes out of the wall?
Yeah. So I love that term, engineering activists. I think that in our generation, engineers, we look at our feet. We're a very introverted type of a group. But I look at the generation that's coming behind us and I'm quite optimistic. And they see engineering as a means to enter the workforce to help solve problems, make the world a better, safer place. The idea that things are really complicated, the idea that the water system may be related to the power infrastructure, which may be related to food supply. And so the idea about activism is being quietly done, I think, by this generation coming behind us who want to make the world a better, safer place. And engineering is a way to enter that workforce. And whether you start there and go into environmental science or become an architect or do something else, engineering at its root is about understanding and solving problems.
And do you see activist engineers emerging from this generation? Do you think the new crop that's coming out is looking less at their feet and more maybe at the sky?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I have a daughter who is a environmental sciences major at Connecticut College, and she very much wants to fix the world. And I see other folks, engineering students who are in the studies who have chosen mechanical engineering in particular because it represents that depth and breadth. And I don't know that they see themselves as activists, but they sure don't tolerate turning our back on the world, understanding that everything is interrelated, whether it's climate or food supply or power generation or water, you name it. And so often environmental sciences is identified as a thing that they can most relate to. But I think as they learn more about it and understand how complex it is, that it turns more towards engineering. And that's why I'm optimistic that this generation is coming up behind us, because they're very aware. They want to fix it here, but they also want to make it improve the quality of life for all 7 billion inhabitants of the planet.
Where do you think this – you know, we've talked a lot about – I mean, I think what's intrigued me about this whole series is identifying what is American about innovation, that clearly it's a universal tendency, and then it involves coming upon problems and solving them and having a tendency and a lack of fear of confronting those problems, that you're just going to like – you believe you can do it. There's some sort of confidence there. There's an element of this that is American, and a lot of immigrants come to the United States and become engineers, and we've heard those stories and that sort of thing. What do you think the particularly American component of innovation is, and where will it be in 20 years? Will it be mixed in with every other culture? Will it move on to some other continent and be there?
So I love that question. I think folks came to this country with a blank sheet. They left for whatever reason over the course of the immigration in this country, they left something behind for something else. And it is this close intertwining of technology and ambition and spirituality. I fear sometimes that we're losing some of that because of the same kind of ignorance that reflects how Flint can come about in that idea that we're kind of taking it for granted. I would want to not be political, but there was a time when there were more engineers in Congress, and I think, frankly, they made better decisions, more thoughtful decisions than some of the strife that we're having now or some of the struggles that the congressmen are having.
Finally, before we go, you've mentioned Flint a couple of times. I get the sense that you feel that as a personal failure, not that you were responsible for it, but that engineers need to have a bigger role in society to prevent things like that from happening.
It's true, John, that Flint was avoidable. As a part of the community that generates standards and tries to make the world a better place, when you see a failure, it hurts. And so we just want to work that much harder at it to make sure it doesn't happen again. I do hope that we as a community see Flint as a learning lesson and not as a political objective or a political football, because it's really important. And it's not just about this country, but it's about the world, and it's about us all trying to figure it out.
Tom, it's always great to talk to you, and I just always get enthused about your passion over all this sort of stuff. And you know, I'll go home and maybe fix that drawer in my kitchen.
Well, thanks,
my
John.
Wife's bugging me.
If you need help, I can refer a couple of engineers to help you. And thank you for your time and attention. Thank you so much for giving for celebrating innovation. It's the American and it's the human endeavor.
Tom Laughlin is Executive Director of ASME, the American Society of Mechanical Engineers. Don't forget, you can vote for America's greatest innovation at thetakeaway.org/innovation. As we've seen all this hour, the American water crisis is not so much a natural disaster or a man-made toxic waste dump, but it is a collective realization that one element of proper American citizenship should be better understanding of how we get water, its natural cycles, the kinds of industrial and agricultural developments that threaten it, and that most importantly, bulldozers and filters can't correct all of the mistakes that can be made in a growing industrial nation. Robert Glennon, who we heard from at the beginning of this hour, says that Americans have to learn to live with the water we have and not live off some imaginary limitless resource we don't have. Robert Glennon is a Regents Professor at the University of Arizona and author of Unquenchable: America's Water Crisis and What to Do About It.
I'm optimistic, John. I don't think it's too late to fix things, but the crisis is real and it demands our attention. The water is still out there. We can't make water, nor can we destroy water. But the problem is it's not where we need it, when we need it, in the form that we need it.
And how would we address that? Does water policy strategically look for questions of shortages and that sort of thing? Or is the strategy that we've had up until now the assumption of an infinite amount of water and we're just adding pipes?
It's been the latter. It's been the assumption that water is plentiful. But there are a number of drivers of the crisis. One is that we have been using water in an unsustainable way. Population growth is the elephant in the room. The Census Bureau predicts that we're going to hit 420 million by 2060. That's an additional 100 million people we have to find water and other resources for. Energy demands are up. Climate change is challenging. So it's a set of factors that come together to make this very serious.
Is there a consensus in the United States on how to proceed? What institutions govern water quality issues? We've traditionally looked at things like the Clean Water Act as the arbiter of questions of water quality. But are those appropriate institutions?
Well, water in the United States is very fragmented. There are literally tens of thousands of drinking water systems, tens of thousands of water treatment plants. We have local institutions, state level, federal institutions. But the Clean Water Act, as you mentioned, has been a real driver in modernizing how we take care of human waste. In the 1970s, the federal government financed the construction of lots and lots of water treatment plants across the United States. But the money for that kind of effort has really dwindled almost to nothing. And now what we're seeing, and I think Flint is a microcosm of this, is a national crisis with our water and wastewater systems. We have over 1.5 million miles of pipes associated with water and wastewater, and the bill is coming due to replacing them. And unfortunately, it's been a situation of out of sight and out of mind. And Flint reminds us of what a problem it is.
Given that, how is it possible, going back to the Flint case, for essentially a small group of people to make a decision that has such an extraordinarily deleterious impact on the health of hundreds of thousands of people?
Well, I think that they're not alone. There are lots of people in position of power. In Flint, and I'm not following it that carefully, but you had multiple layers of regulators not acting as forcefully or as aggressively as perhaps they should have. It's not just confined to Flint, because we now all look wherever we live in the United States and say, well, gosh, what about my water system? And it casts doubt on the quality of the public drinking water supply, and that's really unfortunate.
If Flint raises awareness, is that a good thing? And how would you channel that awareness into concrete steps that would allow us to learn the lessons of Flint?
Well, I think, sadly, it is a good thing. And I think it's a real wake-up call. And I think we need to figure out the way to finance the modernization of water and wastewater systems. And that will not be easy. But I think an example, say, of Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel with public-private partnerships might be ways to generate the finances needed to modernize our systems. It's a very serious national issue, and I think Flint is the wake-up call that you referred to.
What's your solution? Do we ration? Do we create a set of priorities? In California, we've discovered that the advantage that agricultural interests had in their access to water has collided directly with residential access to water. Do we need to revisit those categories?
Again, I'm optimistic. I offer a menu of options. Some of them are very simple. Conservation. It's the low-hanging fruit. So all of your listeners out there should know that every time they use their kitchen food disposal, they're using water. And if they use that disposal only 2 minutes a day, by the end of a month, they will have used 150 gallons of water just to get rid of food scraps. Well, multiplied by all the millions of households in the United States, that's a lot of water. So conservation's one. Reuse is terribly important, and we're not doing nearly enough of it, John. In Los Angeles, they have a huge treatment plant called Hyperion. It produces a volume of water equal to the seventh largest river in the United States, and virtually every drop of that water gets dumped into the Pacific Ocean. Well, we need to do better. And then two things that I'm arguing for. One is we need to price water appropriately. It's too darn cheap for people to take up and pay attention as to how much they use. So I argue for a human right to water for basic needs, and that's only about 1% of the water we use. And then I think we need to have an adult conversation about how to price the other 99%.
And do you think there's the consensus in America to actually accomplish something like that without divisive political debates and demonstrations and the kinds of scenes that are in the movie Chinatown?
Mark Twain once quipped that whiskey's for drinking and water's for fighting over. So we'll always have fights over water. But yes, I think so.
Some creative reforms and some challenging reforms proposed by Robert Glennon, who's a Regents professor at the University of Arizona and author of Unquenchable, America's Water Crisis and What to Do About It. Robert Glennon, thanks so much.
It was a pleasure to be with you, John.
And here's something to take with you. Justice Antonin Scalia, whose death we are mourning today, has made his mark on much of the case law of water rights battles that are still being fought today. And, of course, much, much more. Speaking in September of 2012, Scalia sadly noted how political Supreme Court nominations have become.
When I was confirmed 98 to nothing. They were still looking at qualifications, I guess. I don't think I could get 60 votes today.
Justice Scalia years ago presciently anticipating the battles now underway to replace him. But we want to playfully note before we go one of Scalia's favorite phrases about controversial cases he helped to decide when the arguments are all over. Questioned by Charlie Rose of CBS News about Obamacare and the case Bush v. Gore in 2000, he waved it all away.
But water over the dam.
Water over the dam. Tomorrow, the political battles over Justice Scalia's replacement and the transformation of the 2016 election campaign. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.